We're all familiar with the Ten Commandments listed in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. And many people around the country and the world, they voice a belief in God. And many people have a form of worship of God. So what makes us who are sitting here today so different with regard to our beliefs? Well, when we consider that all of us are here or listening online or catching it later, what we have in common is that we recognize there's a fundamental belief beyond just the belief in God that unites us, keeps us here together. We all have a firm and consistent belief in the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. That's what we have in common. Now, I have several brothers, and two of my younger brothers call themselves Christians because they keep the nine commandments. Well, without telling you which one of those Ten Commandments they don't quite see, we already know, because they have a hard time with the fourth commandment. They just don't see it. Well, God called the fourth commandment a test commandment in Exodus 16, verses 4 and 5. And so that is a test for many people. And as a practical matter in our fellowship, we're so focused on the fourth commandment regarding the Sabbath that we simply take the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments is kind of like automatically understood. Yet, there's a reason that the first three commandments are listed before the fourth commandment. Well, the first commandment is really understanding, and it's in Exodus 20, verses 2 and 3. It's really understanding who is God and then setting our priorities. In the Holman Christian Study Bible, Exodus 20, verses 2 and 3, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. Do not have other gods besides me. So it's a matter of priorities. And we think, well, that's easy. We've got that one. We already know that. We already have a foundation of worshiping the one true God. After all, we're keeping the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week, as a time to very much to honor and worship that God. And then we have the second commandment, and that's about no false images of God. And that's in Exodus in 20 in verses 4 through 6. And it says we don't make idols or graven images and so forth and worship them. And again, we say ourselves, well, we've got this. None of us have idols or statues or images set up in our homes. None of us put symbols of worship like statuettes in our cars. We don't wear icons on our neck that represent some kind of image of God. We just aren't into chiseling statues to make believe that they are God, so we have something to worship. So that one sounds like an easy commandment for us. And then there's the third commandment, respect for God's name in Exodus 20 and verse 7. Again, reading out of the Holman Bible, do not misuse the name of God for the Lord your God, because the Lord will not leave anyone unpunished who misuses his name. And once again, we think to ourselves, well, that's pretty basic. We don't go around using God's name in vain, so that's really not a hard commandment to understand or even to obey. Well, today I want us to ask ourselves, if these three first commandments are so basic and so easy to understand, why did God see fit to have those commandments chiseled into stone? Additionally, why did God direct in Deuteronomy 6 that those commandments should be written on our hearts and on the hearts of our children and our grandchildren? I want to entitle today's message, Bowing Down to Baal. Bowing Down to Baal. Well, after the recitation of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5, God gives these instructions, I've just mentioned in Deuteronomy 6, in verses 1 and 2. And it starts in verse 1. Now, this is the commandment, and these are the statutes, judgments, which the Lord your God has commanded you to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you're crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. If we take a look at mankind, it has a 6,000-year history of ignoring then what God says. What does God say? You learn this. These are the basics. And then you learn them. You teach them to your children and to your grandchildren. So it'll go on for generations. Yet mankind has ignored what God says. In fact, early in mankind's history, Eve and Adam were thrust out of the Garden of Eden for succumbing to the advances of Satan. And with precious few exceptions, the world's population beyond Adam and Eve went their own way without acknowledging God or living according to God's precepts. Well, the world got so bad in not too much time that it's in its sin and mystery that God prepared Noah to salvage a small group of people, Noah's family, along with the land animals of the earth, and inundated then the world with a cleansing flood. And we read that in Genesis 6, in verses 5 and 7. I'm not going to read it all, but God saw that the wickedness was great, and he wanted to clean this up. The intent of everyone's heart was wicked all the time. It was everywhere. And God said he was going to have to destroy the man and start over again. And after the great flood, the family of Noah then began to repopulate the earth. And within a few generations, what happens? Once again, people chose to go their own way in Genesis 9, verses 1 and 2. People went their own way, discarding the knowledge of God. In chapter 9, Genesis 9, and verse 1, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and all that move on the earth, and all fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. So mankind was put into a dominant place. And have you ever noticed if you go in the woods, do the animals run away from you? Ooh, does that occur to you that this maybe has a connection with Genesis 9? And if they don't, they might be a rabbit or something, and you probably don't want to get too close to them. And it doesn't matter whether it's an animal or a bird. In verse 6 in Genesis 9, God made a very important point here because we're now after the Cain and Abel incident. Verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood by man, his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply it. So God put a value on human life. Don't mess with it. Keep it. And the offspring of Noah did in fact reproduce and repopulate the earth. But as we've noticed, many of them then went their own way, ignoring God and God's precepts. Now, if they'd have been left alone, God then could see that these people would bring about the destruction of mankind in a remarkably short time. We read about that in Genesis 11. In Genesis 11, in verse 1, we're only looking at the one short verse. Now, the whole world had one language and one speech. So this was after Noah, and people could freely communicate. They started off with Noah and his sons and daughters-in-law, and the earth repopulated. And then in verses 2 through 4, we read that the people wanted to build a city and a tower at a place called Babel. Their priorities were not towards acknowledging and worshiping their Creator God. They were bent on a course that would lead them to destruction. In Genesis 11, then, in verse 5, and this is in the Common English Bible, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the humans built. And the Lord said, there's now one people, and they all have one language. This is what they've begun to do, and now all they plan to do will be possible for them. There was a lot of productivity because they all spoke and understood the same language. Verse 7, let's go down and mix up their languages so they can't understand each other's language. Why would God do that? Verse 8, then the Lord dispersed them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore it is named Babel, because there is the Lord mixed up the language of the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them from all over the world. Well, here's an example of what God was stepping in to redirect the flow of destiny of man, and once again, to salvage man from quickly destroying itself. Before, God had to step in with the flood because mankind was destroying itself and he had to clean it up and start over. And here again, people were bent on self-destruction. They were focused. God said, well, there's nothing that they can't do. They won't be restrained. And and so then by people automatically then segregated themselves by their languages into different groups and scattered to the far ends of the earth. Well, it was over 40 years ago, I had a world languages class in college, And we learned then, and I was surprised, I still am, there were over 4,000 languages on earth. What was just as surprising is over 1,000 of those were in China. Gulp, and China was a smaller country then. Well, China has been squeezing out in the last 40, 50 years the languages and imposing a national language of Mandarin. So there's now today, in the last 40, 50 years, they've reduced it from 1,000 down to 300 active languages in China. Years ago, I was working for a Chinese company in Los Angeles, and the warehouse foreman was named Bill. That's the American name he chose. Bill spoke 5 languages. His first language is his local village language, and his second language was a regional language, Shanghainese, named after the city of Shanghai. So he had a local language, he knew that, and then Shanghainese, he knew that one. And his third language was Mandarin, the national governmental language. But because Bill was a really smart guy, he was drafted into the Chinese Air Force. But at that time, many years ago, China didn't produce its own military jets. They bought them from Russia. So in order to fly the jets, Bill had to learn Russian. That was his fourth language. Well, after he got out of the military for 20 years, he could then emigrate, and he came to the United States, and English was his fifth language. Bill was my interpreter to communicate with China from English back into Shanghainese, actually Cantonese, and Mandarin. Well, multiple languages in a country slow down its productivity. And as China centralizes its language, focusing on Mandarin, they are now increasing their productivity. They're doing the reverse Babel effect by increasing their productivity. There's another big country in the world, India. The second most populated country on earth has today about 780 active languages, although the official government languages are Hindi and English. And I was surprised many years ago that many of these individual languages have their own version of the Hindu religion. I just didn't know that Hinduism wasn't just one religion. It was lots of different versions of it because Hinduism wasn't the same all over India. Well, the scattering of peoples by languages at the city and Tower of Babel did slow down the speed of mankind's route to self-annihilation. And here we are, about 4,000 years later, where mankind is still largely ignoring God for the most part in their daily lives and ignoring God's precepts for a happy life. And today, mankind is attempting to build its modern version of the tower in the city of Babel through technology, centralized governance, as we approach the end of this age. And we have available to us several tools to understand what's happening. We have the archaeological record. Some of you have seen, what is that, Indiana Jones movies. We have an archaeological record. We've got a secular historical record. We can read Josephus or any other secular historian. And we have the biblical record. And what do those show us? That people have been worshiping false gods for thousands of years. So we can ask ourselves, why do people worship false gods? Well, first of all, let's look what happens in Romans 1:28. What happens when people leave the study of God to worship false gods in Romans 1 and verse 28? And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind. The King James Version says a reprobate mind, to do those things which are not fitting. Now, that was, I read that in the New King James. The insert was a King James. The King James says, do things which are not convenient. Well, the payment for the result of sin is very inconvenient. Well, so, but the New King James says it's not fitting. Author Ayn Rand had an interesting explanation as to why people follow an evil path. In one of her books, she says, the spread of evil is the symptom of a vacuum. Whenever evil wins, it is only by default, by the moral failure of those who evade the fact that there can be no compromise on basic principles. Now, Ayn Rand was not a believer in God, but she understood this. If you don't believe in something and stand up for it, evil, or something resembling in her mind what was evil, will take over. If there's a vacuum, nature will abhor the vacuum and fill it, and it will fill it with evil. Sort of like a field. For every farmer knows if you have plowed the field and you don't plant something, what's going to grow? Will it just stay vacant? Weeds will grow, and it will, and they will reproduce, and weeds somehow seem to do very well in almost every circumstance, different kinds of weeds. Just ask my garden. Let's take a look at what one of the solutions here in James 4 and verse 8, because Ayn Rand said, well, if there's a vacuum, evil will flow in to fill it in James 4 and verse 8. We read a solution here. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Fundamentally, we can't have it both ways. There's no compromise. Either we choose God, or evil will creep into our hearts and lives. There was an author named Eric Hoffer, wrote a book in 1951. His book was entitled The True Believer. He points out that people have a nature, they are compelled in their own mind to believe in something. They grab onto that something, and then they defend their beliefs, even if the beliefs are not rational, reasonable, or helpful. Now, you would think, well, Eric Hoffer is a fine, upstanding intellectual with lots of degrees. No. He was a longshoreman, a stevedore in San Francisco in the 1940s. And he self-educated, decided his observations of humanity, and he wrote about him, wrote several books. But The True Believer was really a remarkable book. It was quoted by and got fame when President Eisenhower quoted the book. I remember reading the book in 1972, and at that time, the non-Christians were attempting to say that belief in God was just a phase and that people were going through. They just had a search for meaning, and oh, they'll just hang on to this belief in God because, after all, they got to believe in something, so that's just as good as any other belief. And people mock those who came into the church. Well, they've got to cling to something, even if it is crazy, like this church over here. Well, we know that people desperately, in their nature, want to believe in something. And if they don't know the truth, or if they don't acknowledge or respect and accept the truth, then they will fill the void with something else, some kind of what we would call a pagan belief system. And we have a remarkable history of mankind doing just that, replacing the belief in a true God with alternate belief systems. Well, God knew that mankind would be drawn to false religion, so he put in place the Ten Commandments to guide us. And he chiseled those Ten Commandments in stone, and he had those ancient Israelites drag that around with them everywhere they went in the Ark of the Covenant. And as they went through the wilderness after the Exodus from Egypt, they hauled it around on poles. It was a constant reminder. They had a home for it in a tabernacle or tent, and later built a temple when they hit the promised land. As we read earlier in Deuteronomy 6, God impels us each to carve the Ten Commandments into our hearts and to teach them to our future generations. Well, the children of Israel lived in Egypt for 430 years. They were well aware of the false gods of Egypt. That was the world they lived in. So I thought, well, I'll look it up. Just how many false gods of Egypt could there be? You know, we hear of this, that, or the other thing. So I went to worldhistory.org, and they said, well, here are 23 letters of the alphabet to help you index all of the gods of Egypt. And every letter of the alphabet, of the 26 letters we have, there were 23 of them that had lists of pagan gods under each letter of that alphabet. And that was I just didn't know there were that many, but they had gods for everything. Well, by the time the children of Israel left Egypt, those who departed with Moses then, after 430 years, they had to relearn the truths of God. They had to relearn the Sabbath, and God did that with the use of the delivery of manna. They had to learn to reject false gods. The Israelites had to come to the point where they relied on God for water, for food, for the very sustenance in life. They were being retaught. And if you take a look at how long they'd been in Egypt, for over 400 years, how many generations was that? Well, that was quite a few generations. If we take a look, where were we? Where was this place in Arkansas 430 years ago? Well, let's see. That would be about 1591, somewhere in that, or is it somewhere around there? And at that time, we have the Spanish had conquered Mexico. There was no eastern seaboard, had not been settled by the English, and Native Americans roamed the land, and as the historians found out, they were having a terrible go of it themselves with regards to all kinds of diseases and other issues. And they were busy killing and enslaving each other and other such, as we find out. Well, in Exodus 19 and 20, just prior to the Ten Commandments, where we read, we know that Moses went up to the Mount Sinai, and he was up there for 40 days and 40 nights. And at that time, he then received instructions from God, including the Ten Commandments that were carved in stone by the finger of God. We know that in Exodus 31:18, that God provided him with that in stone. But those 40 days and 40 nights, the Israelites were impatient. Who is this guy, Moses, and where is he? In Exodus 32, verses 1 through 7, we read, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said, 'Come, make us gods, that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him.'" Well, what if any one of us just disappeared for 40 days and 40 nights? We'd kind of wonder, did they drop off the end of the earth? Nobody's seen him. Nobody's heard him. Nobody's talked. There's no cell phone, no landline phone, no texting, no email. Just gone. He just went off to some mountain and didn't see him again. So what in verse 2 of Exodus 32? "And Aaron," now this is Moses' older brother, "said to them, 'Break off golden earrings, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons and daughters, and bring them to me.'" Where did they get the gold? Remember when they left Egypt? The Egyptians heaped upon them. Just go here. Stop the plagues. Just go away here. You can have all this. Just get out. Verse 3, "So people broke off the gold earrings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron, and Aaron received the gold from their hand, fashioned it with an engraving tool, and made a molded calf. Then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" So they had to have an image. They had to have something to worship instead of just this invisible God, and Moses is gone, so we're going to have to look out after ourselves. We're going to have this new process here. Verse 5, "So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it." Well, hey, he's being politically correct for the day. We'll just go along with what the people want. They want an image. We'll build an altar. And where does it continuing on in verse 5? "Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And here's your golden calf that you can worship.' And so they brought peace offerings, and they sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." So it clearly wasn't a real holy day. That's not what you would do on those days. And what did God say in verse 7? "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go, get down. The people whom you brought out of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They've turned aside quickly out of the way which I've commanded them. They've made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And God said, 'In fact, this is so disappointing, I'm ready to wipe them out. We'll start over with you, Moses.'" God is experienced at this. Okay, he can wipe things out and start over. And Moses was well noted as being extraordinarily humble, said, "Please, let's not do that. You know, don't put that on me. They're your people. Let's work with them." And God, with a forgiving heart, followed through. But you notice how readily the 2 million children of Israel substituted a belief in God with a golden calf. Now, they still called it God. They still went through the motions, and they still had a feast day, as it were. Aaron made arranged for that. And they were familiar with the carved and the molded images out of Egypt because of the many dozens of pagan gods where they came from in Egypt. But God listened to the Moses' plea and didn't wipe out the children of Israel. We read that in Deuteronomy 10:10. But later on, when the 10 of the 12 spies convinced Israelites not to go to the promised land, what did God say? He said, okay, then if you don't want to go, you can just stay here in the desert for 40 years. And we read that in Numbers 14, verses 33 through 35. He said, you can just all die in the wilderness. If you don't want to go there, it'll be the next generation that will go into the promised land. And those 40 years for the next generations were spent learning what? Learning God's laws, learning the Ten Commandments, learning how to keep the Sabbath, how to treat each other. It was that younger generation whom God allowed to enter the promised land. When Moses was up on Mount Sinai, he was given specific instructions regarding the children of Israel, what they were to do when they entered the promised land. In Exodus 23, in verse 24, God is telling them very clearly what not to do. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do anything, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. God was drawing a distinct and a clear line. Don't mess with the false gods. Get rid of, destroy them. Jumping down to verse 32, Exodus 23, verse 32. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now, I know what a snare is. Now, I've not used them, but I had a Boy Scout manual. I know how to build a snare, how to track something. A snare is a track, is a trap. You don't even know it, and you're caught. Or whatever you're hunting can get caught. Well, getting involved in pagan belief systems will be a snare for us as well. After all, look what happened shortly after, during the time that the children of Israel were in the wilderness and camped near the land of Moab. In Numbers 23, starting in verse 1, many of the Israelite men committed harlotry with the Baal worshippers of Moab. They were mixing it up with the neighbors. In Numbers 23, starting in verse 1, Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods, plural. So Israel was being subverted. They were being snared by the attractive women in Moab. So Israel was joined together to Baal of Peor. It was a local Baal. They have geographic gods and the Baal of that area. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Now, the Baal of Peor was a local fertility god who believed that the people believed that he would enable the earth to produce and to that people could produce children. Why was that a problem that they could produce children? Well, we're going to read on and we'll get a hint to that. Because of the sin of the Israelite men, God ordered the offenders among the Israelites to be purged. Killed. They would die of a plague or they would be killed. And yet one Israelite man, in Numbers 25, verse 7, one Israelite man openly rebelled against God and consorted with a Moabite woman in front, openly, in front of the priests and other witnesses. And Numbers 25 and verse 7, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, who was a priest, and who was the son of Aaron, the priest, rose up and put a stop to the sinning and thus ended the plague. Now, this was quite a plague, so that you could see there was a lot of cohabitation going on. In verse 9, those who died in the plague were 24,000. That's a big problem. Some of you may have heard of author Steve Collins. He's written 5 books on the history of Israel from ancient times to modern times. And his speculation is the reason the Israelites were to remain separated from other peoples was because of rampant STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. This type of plague has been a problem in many parts of the world for thousands of years. The STDs afflict those who do not keep God's laws. God knew what he was talking about when he told Israel to avoid mixing it up with the other people and their false gods, which gives you mind they had a god for fertility because fertility could have been a problem for them because of the STDs. 40 years later, God you will notice God's instructions when the children of Israel were entering the promised land. We go through Joshua 1 for that. But I want to go to the warning that God gave in Joshua 23 and starting in verse 6. God gave instructions. Here's what to do and here's how to do it earlier in the book of Joshua. And then in Joshua 23 and verse 6, starting in 23 verse 6, be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left. Remember those words we looked at about snares? They're there. And verse 7, lest you go among the nations, those who remain among you, you shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them. But that wasn't the only warning. In Joshua 23, we go on to verse 16. Because he knew that some people would succumb. In Joshua 23 and verse 16, when you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commands you, and have gone and served other gods, and bowed down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land which he has given you. It was a self-destructive bit of behavior if people went and worshipped an alternate belief system. Notice there is a constant reinforcement here of the first three of the Ten Commandments. The first commandment, of course, was understanding who is God and setting our priorities toward that God. The second commandment, no false images of God. And the third commandment is respect for God's name. That means we can't really call ourselves God's children and then abandon what God says to do. That would be taking God's name in vain. So let's look around the world. Throughout history, there have been, and there are many religions that we can, there were many, many dozens in just Egypt alone. Well, Baal worship, we read about that frequently in the Bible, and there was different Baal gods for each geographic area. And then, of course, you may have heard of Baphomet. That's a type of Satan worship that's symbolized by a goat's head on a human body. And that type of satanic worship is still active today. In fact, if you want to see it, you can just drive down to Dixon Street at the university, and there's a window that has this whole stained glass Baphomet picture window. You can clearly see it on display there. And if you look out through history, a very popular false religion was promoting the pagan god Mithra, or Mithraism is often referred to as Mithraic Mysteries, a Roman mystery religion centered on the god Mithra. And it was really originally centered in Persia, which is now Iran. And these were very popular in the Roman army in the first 300 years since the birth of Christ. And these worshipers of Mithra had a complex system, and they had initiation and communal ritual meals and so forth, seven steps that you get through. And there are lodges today that have those kinds of initiations. Only this one was, they had special handshakes. They would meet in underground temples. In fact, they would have pits in these temples. And this pagan god Mithra is pictured as slaying a bull. Or bleeding out a bull. What they would do is put the new initiates, the new converts, into this pit with a grate over it, and then the priest would slice the bull's jugular vein, and it would spray the blood all over these people that were in the pit, thus giving them a type of baptism. It was really a mockery of true baptism. So they would be baptized by the blood of the bull. Mithraism was viewed as a rival of early Christianity. It was extant there in the first several hundred years following Christ's birth. And if today you go through East Asia, you'll come across many statues of, no surprise, Buddha. And there are temples to Buddhism. And it's interesting to note that the Buddhist statues in India tend to be skinny by comparison, kind of a reflection of society and reflecting poverty. Well, the Buddhist statues in Southeast Asia and Japan tend to be chubby, sort of a symbol of wealth. In visiting Japan, we were at the World Expo, 2005. So we saw all of these at different booths of all of these countries throughout Asia. And so you could see the different Buddhas from the different countries. And then, of course, going to the Buddhist temples themselves was quite an eye-opener. at that time. You could see and they would touch some of these temples. The people would line up to go and touch and rub the Buddha statue. And you could see that it would touched in certain places so much that it rubbed it so that you could see it change the coloration of those particular statues. years ago, I was in the industrial supply, the distribution business in Oregon. And one of my suppliers was in Los Angeles. It was a Japanese company. And they had a main warehouse and office in Los Angeles. Well, I was there to visit that office. And there was a large section next to their office, a big room that was a dedicated shrine. And I'm looking at that. What is? And I inquired. I said, well, what's the purpose there? Well, that's when I found out the entire purpose of the company was to earn money to promote Shintoism, that their entire focus and function and purpose, and they were a big company, was to make money that they could plug back into all of the literature and the belief system to promote that for the rest of the world. And they were taking American money and then doing this. It was quite an eye-opener. And they had their little shrines in that particular room. Well, the book of Judges, if we look in the Bible, is replete with story after story after story of the importance of tearing down wooden images, stone images, molded images that would otherwise lead astray the children of Israel. Well, people are quite susceptible to being pulled away by strange gods if they're not strongly bound to the true God. So then let's ask ourselves, why do people worship false gods? And we back to Romans 1:28, as we read earlier. And even then, as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. Well, one of my daughters has a degree in classical studies. She studied Latin and Greek. And the history of the Greek and Roman empires is fraught with the worship of pagan mythical gods. An example of an ancient Roman god is Bacchus, the Roman god of wine and fertility. And I guess they get drunk and reproduce. According to Roman mythology, Bacchus wandered the earth learning about the culture of the vine and the mysteries of winemaking. So pagan gods were often geographic. There was a god of this area or a god of that area. And if we would apply it here, well, there's a god of Bentonville and a god of Fayetteville and then a local god over here in Rogers and maybe one in Springdale. And they would each have that. In fact, we heard recently on the sermonette about Naaman. And that's why he wanted to take soil back from Israel and take it back to Syria because, well, take some of that God's soil and take it back to my home and take it back there. And maybe that'll work out better for me. So some of the pagan gods were geographic and others were job specific, like this Bacchus, the Roman god of wine. I know my daughter is one of the first papers that I think that we looked to proofread. I said, what are you writing this for? And she says, it's an analysis of Ethluea, whatever Greek or Roman goddess that was. She said, oh, it's the goddess of childbirth, of midwifery. And she was specialized in taking a look at their beliefs about being midwives and so forth. So they had a god that was some focused on functions, some focused on geography. Well, there's an extraordinary biblical example in Daniel about a king who set up a pagan image and creating a god in order to control people. We have that example in the book of Daniel. And in Daniel 1, we read about this fellow named King Nebuchadnezzar. He ultimately conquered Jerusalem in 587. He had about a two-year siege to do it. Came over from Babylon, 2 years to conquer the city. That means the walls were strong. People were fortified, they had water, they had food, they were able to fight. And it took 2 years for them to break down the city walls and ruin the temple and haul everything off. In Daniel 1:1, and he also then hauled away the people, left only a few poor people left in the land. Now, according to one of the Jewish commentaries I read this week, Nebuchadnezzar was a relatively small man. So he built an extraordinarily tall image that he demanded for people in Babylon to worship. And so we'll read about this image that Nebuchadnezzar did. And it kind of reminds me of, if some of you have seen the movie Shrek, this was 2001, 20 years ago. And you had this character, a boss of a castle named Lord Farquaad. And he's about half the height of everybody else. So to get up on the horse, he always had to have help and assistance. And of course, everything else around him was big. The horse was big. The castle was big, sort of like a compensation for his lack of stature and by being extraordinarily cruel to others. I remember in the movie, one of the famous little speeches, he said, you know, this is a very important battle. Some of you may die, but that is a sacrifice I'm willing to make. Well, I would be very uncomfortable with a leader like that, but Lord Farquaad saw it was perfectly normal. Well, you have King Nebuchadnezzar now builds this tall, and we read in Daniel 3 in verse 1, just about this image, that Nebuchadnezzar wanted people to worship. Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 3 verse 1, the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits. That's 90 feet tall. That's about a little taller than the length of this building. And its width, 6 cubits. Well, that would be about 9 feet wide. So it was a tall, golden statue of some kind, or an obelisk. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So it's in a plain. What does that mean? You can see it for a long ways away. Then in Daniel 3 and verse 5, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Well, that's interesting. Sort of like, what's the name of that musical chairs? When the music stops, everybody grabs a seat. Well, this is in reverse. When the music starts, everybody has to bow to this particular obelisk or this particular statue. Well, when we go through this in the book of Daniel, we get the stories about Daniel, who refused to bow down to the image, was cast into the fiery furnace, and yet was protected by God. We have the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who suffered getting, Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach, they suffered from the lions, they suffered from being thrown into a fiery furnace. We have those examples. Well, it was about 70 years that the Jews were in captivity in Babylon. And then we have the examples of Ezra and Nehemiah, who were returned to Jerusalem under a later emperor in Babylon, and they rebuilt the walls of the city and then rebuilt the temple. Well, the evidence of worship of pagan gods is all over the world. We have the Temple of Bacchus in Lebanon today. It's still there, and it's bigger than the Parthenon in Greece. It's larger than that. It was built about the year 150 AD. It's right next to another Temple of Jupiter that was built 300 years earlier, just north of Israel in the land of Lebanon. Then there was a major world religion formed through the rise of the Islamic Empire, started in the year 610. It started in Arabia, and it went east and west from there to Persia, India, and wealth across North Africa and the Mediterranean. And they forcibly compelled, by the point of a sword, people to worship their moon god, Allah. And, of course, many did at the point of the sword, confess to Allah or die. And people said, oh, okay, we'll kind of go along with that. Maybe live another day. An estimated 1.9 billion Muslims in the world today. And all bowing to what? The moon god Allah. We have ancient and medieval rulers often use pagan religions as an excuse to conquer and rule as a form of obeisance to their gods. Well, that's what the Muslim Empire did. They said, well, we're going to spread Islam, so we'll therefore conquer all of these places. Before the birth of Christ, the Greeks and Macedonians under Alexander the Great conquered much of the then known world in the Mediterranean and Middle East area, all the way to Persia and Afghanistan. Later, the Romans took over the same area, conquering from the Middle East all the way to England. How do you suppose true Christians were treated during that time of the world conquerors? We know that many of, if not most of the secular rulers, were not a benefit to the well-being of Christians. In fact, it was the opposite. For example, King Herod, the Tetrarch of Judea under Roman rule, had the cousin of Jesus Christ, John the Baptizer, beheaded when John boldly stood up to the ruler and openly pointed out Herod's sins. In Matthew 14:10, its verse we read simply, "So he," meaning Herod, "sent and had John beheaded in prison." How many of us are that bold? How many of us are willing to stand up as John the Baptizer did to the ruler of that day and openly proclaim what is sin? Jesus Christ set an example, speaking boldly to the rulers of his day. In John 7, verses 25 and 26, in John 7. "Now some of them from Jerusalem said, 'Is this not he whom they seek to kill?' So Jesus Christ knew that they were out to kill him. 'But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ?'" Christ spoke boldly. If we look at Acts 9 and verse 20, Saul, the one who became Paul as a newly converted Christian, spoke boldly in the synagogue in Damascus. In Acts 9 and verse 20, immediately, this is after Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus, he preached the gospel in the synagogues that he, meaning Jesus, is the Son of God. Verse 21, "And all who heard were amazed and said, 'Is this not he who destroyed those who called on his name, this name in Jerusalem, and who came here for the purpose that he might bring them bound to the chief priests?'" The whole purpose for Saul to go to Damascus was to haul back and indeed kill the true believers in Jesus Christ. So what happens? We read and keep reading in Acts 9 and verse 22. The Jews, they couldn't refute Paul. He was so effective at his message delivery that they decided to kill him in Acts 9 verse 22. "But Saul increased all the more in strength and confounded the Jews who dwelt in Damascus, proving that this Jesus is the Christ." Wow. So he had the knowledge, but did not yet respond to the conversion until that trip. Verse 23, "Now after many days were passed, the Jews plotted to kill him." They couldn't shut him up. He was preaching the truth. And you will find that people who preach the truth then engender people who want to kill them, certainly to shut them up. We read in Acts 18, we're in the book of Acts, in 18 of verse 26, there's a new convert to Christianity, a Jew named Apollos. And he preached boldly. In Acts 18, verse 26, he, Apollos, began to speak boldly in the synagogue. What's the synagogue? Well, that's where the Jews met. "When Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately." They wanted to make sure that he got it right. They didn't stand up to him and say, "Oh, you forgot a point." No, they took him privately, and Aquila and Priscilla helped him out. Verse 28 in Acts 18, "For he," meaning Apollos, "he vigorously refuted the Jews publicly, showing from the scriptures that Jesus is the Christ." It's pretty brave. Stand up in that venue and pronounce the truth. I'd like us now to turn to Revelation 20 and verse 4, because there's a scenario there at the return of Jesus Christ. Not everything turned out really well for people who stood up boldly, or at least initially in their own mind. Here's a scenario at the return of Christ in Revelation 20 and verse 4. "I saw the thrones and they that sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So you have this, here we have this knowledge that there were people who spoke boldly and they were beheaded. We know John the Baptizer was. And we read, you'll notice here, it's not a singular. It doesn't say the person who was beheaded. It's talking about multiples. Okay, those who had for their witness. In Hebrews 11, starting in verse 35, in Hebrews 11 and verse 35, we read a little more graphically about what happens to people who are willing to stand up for their beliefs, as Ayn Rand said. breaking into the verse in Hebrews 11, verse 35, in the middle of the verse, others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. We had that sermon a couple months ago from a visitor, Mr. Baker, out of Texas, about a better resurrection. They weren't going to give up a better resurrection for worshiping a false god or denying the truth. Verse 36, still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. Verse 37, they were stoned. I was hit with a stone once. It was a small stone, thrown from quite a ways, hurt like the dickens. Okay, I'll take bigger stones or hundreds or thousands of little ones. And it's a very painful experience. They were sawn in two. I saw that at a state fair once where they had the carnival, where they had the lady go into the box. Then they sawed the lady in two, and then she came out of the box. I was amazed. Of course, I was only 10 or 11 years old at the time. Didn't know how in the world they could do that. But this is for real. This isn't fake. This wasn't done at a circus or a sideshow. They were tempted. They were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. Why were they wearing those things? Because they didn't have the means or ability to produce cloth, or weren't able to buy and sell. They dressed themselves with what they could, which would be sheepskins and goatskins. Afflicted and tormented, they couldn't buy and sell. Of whom the world was not worthy. In other words, the world didn't deserve them. They were true to the truth. And yet the world was not. Verse 39, continuing on in verse 38, they wandered in deserts and mountains in the dens and caves of the earth. They didn't have a regular home as we would think of it. Verse 39, and those having obtained a good testimony through faith did not receive the promise. They didn't go to the promised land. They hadn't yet been to the kingdom of God. Verse 40, God provided something better for us that they should not be made perfect apart from us. They have another opportunity. Their salvation is coming. Well, those who worship false gods, who will pervert the belief in the truths of God, are vehemently opposed to the true God and the redemption offered by the sacrifice of Christ. For thousands of years, this has been the scenario where believers in the true God must boldly face the false gods of this world. And there are many false gods that leave people astray. We could go through a list of Genghis Khan, who had the hordes of Khan that raided across Russia and then raided Europe for 100 years. He and his sons and grandsons did it. Interestingly enough, Genghis Khan was what we call a Tengrist. That was his religion. He had shamans or witch doctors, and they would perform rituals, and then he would listen through them to the spirits of his ancestors about state affairs or when he was to launch a war. Ooh, where have we heard about that before, where somebody does ancestor worship and looking at the dark side? His family greatly valued shamanism. So just read up on the dark side, and you can read about that. It's of worshiping a false god, a satanic belief system. When the hordes of Khan came across Asia in the 1200s, people knew they were coming in Europe because the refugees would be fleeing afraid of those armies. And what did he bring to Europe? The bubonic plague or black plague. About a third to half of the people in Europe died from that. Interestingly, though, the Mongols didn't interfere with local religion. They didn't have to. A lot of it was pagan already. Later, we had, in the late 1200s, we had a fellow named Tamerlane, the last nomadic conqueror in what is now Uzbekistan. He tried to duplicate what Genghis Khan did. He was going to be the big shot. And he did. He beheaded thousands of people. In fact, he had pyramids made of 100,000 heads in Afghanistan, in India, and each place he went, he would build a pyramid with human heads out of their heads. And 100,000 is a lot of people, let alone just a lot of heads, a lot of bloody work. And his excuse was, well, they weren't Muslim, so therefore it was okay to kill them. Or if they were Muslim, they weren't good enough Muslims, so we have to purify them. So we have the Muslims that invaded, of course, North Africa in 700. They conquered Spain. And in Spain, they were ruled by the Muslim Empire for 700 years. Now, it appears that those were a little more tolerant, that Jews and Roman Catholics and Sabbatarian Christians could live in Spain during that time, but it had to be hard because you had to keep a low profile. Ultimately, in the 1400s, Spain threw off the Muslim empire and reestablished itself as a largely unified Spain. So what did Spain do? It immediately said, we're a Roman Catholic country and we're purging everybody who doesn't believe like we do. And you have to get out, but you can't take your possessions with you, and you can't convert it to money and take the money with you. Unless, of course, they did secretly. And that meant that all Jews and Sabbatarian Christians were purged from Spain. You say, wait a minute, how could there be Sabbatarian Christians? Turn to Acts 15, verse 24 and 28. We know it because the Apostle Paul was visiting Spain and said so. In fact, there are many references elsewhere in the Bible, but I just put those. Paul says, well, when I get to it, I'll be visiting you there. Acts 15, verses 24 and 28. So they had the Spanish Inquisition to purify all of those who weren't Roman Catholic. And how do they convince you to become a good Roman Catholic? They put you on a rack or a wheel and pull your limbs from your body until you agree to be a good Catholic. And then, oops, if they pulled it a little bit too far, well, too bad, go for the next one. Or maybe a little boiling oil will help you convince you. Well, throughout the Middle Ages, Sabbatarian Christians were persecuted. They learned to live in their own communities. They hid in the mountains of Italy and France, away from the population centers. Didn't we read earlier in Scripture that people hid in the mountains in sheepskins and goatskins? And who would persecute Sabbatarian Christians? Well, those who believed in false gods, or those who believed in dishonoring the gospel of the true God. In England, there was a Bible translator named Wycliffe. John Wycliffe translated the Bible from Latin into English in the year 1384. Well, everybody was supposed to read the Bible in Latin. And both the church and the government said, wait a minute, we can't be having that. You can't have it just translated. Why, that would be wrong. So they passed a law that said it makes it illegal to produce any of those more copies of the Wycliffe translation. So what people did is when they wrote out the Bible, that translation, they just put an old date on it because it was all hand transcribed to make it look like it was produced earlier. But it came from the Latin, not from the original Hebrew and Greek. Well, it was then 150 years later, a man named William Tyndale and his helpers developed a translation of the Bible drawing directly from Hebrew and Greek text. And then Tyndale did something. In addition to that, he did like John the Baptizer. When John the Baptizer confronted Herod the Tetrarch and said, you shouldn't be married to that woman, what did William Tyndale do? He wrote a piece, we can read it today, declaring that Henry VIII was in violation of the scriptures by marrying and disposing of so many wives. And as you can imagine, it made the king angry. And it's not healthy to make the king angry. And so Tyndale fled across the English Channel to Belgium. He was arrested anyway, convicted of heresy, and then publicly strangled, and a body stood up and burned. Years later, under a new king, it was less than 100 years later, and there was a new king, King James I, who put together a team of 47 scholars who produced the King James Version of the Bible. And what did William Tyndale? Now remember, Tyndale did this at risk, and then, as John the Baptizer, confronted the king, the power of the day, and pointed out sin, which I must say was bold. And what did the King James translators do? They drew from Tyndale's work to create the King James Bible. One estimate is that the New Testament in the King James is 83% of Tyndale's translation, and the Old Testament 76%. That's the man who was willing to take a chance with the truth and be bold with the truth. Well, false teachings and government restraints couldn't stop the truth from being published. Government censorship cost people their lives. People like William Tyndale were horribly killed. Others were drawn and quartered for opposing the religious hierarchy or the government of their day. And that doesn't mean you're like drawing on a piece of paper. When they say drawn, it means they slice the bottom of the abdomen and they tie a rope onto the intestines. On one end, the other end of the rope is tied onto the tail of a horse. They slap the horse on the rump and the horse goes running off while you're tied and your intestines get dragged out in front of you. This is not, this has got to be extraordinarily painful, but they're not done yet. Now, while the person is still alive and being degutted, now they put a horse tied onto each limb and they tug it up tight. And while the horse is pulled up tight, then they use a sword and they quarter them in four parts. So there's one limb attached to each part of the body. That's what it meant to be a Christian who was deemed to be a heretic. And there were many in that day. So what is referred to then in Hebrews 11, verses 35 through 40, and Revelations 20, verse 4, we read those, that death would be considered merciful compared to the horrible tortures that people had when they look at the mockings and the scourgings and chains and imprisonment, being stoned, sawed in two, tempted to do evil and slain with the sword and wandering in sheepskins and so forth in the desert. We think of those things as happening in the past because we live in a safe and comfortable part of the world. And yet somehow, these things are still happening around the world today. Lest we doubt it, we can go to places, whether it's China, Afghanistan, North Korea, or many other places where the governments enslave and oppress their own people. And yet somehow, by the grace of God, true Christians have survived and have carried on the work of preaching the gospel. In the past century, the 1900s, over 100 million people were killed by their own authoritarian collectivist governments. Now, I want that to sink in for a moment. 100 million people were killed by their own governments, the very governments who claimed that they were acting in the best interest of society. And we could make a list, a long list of those horrible regimes that practiced authoritarian collectivism. We can add to it Nikolai Lenin and Joseph Stalin of Russia and the Soviet Union. We know that Stalin carried out the Great Famine, the Holodomor in Ukraine, where Stalin deliberately starved 4 million Ukrainians to death in 1932 and 33. And then, but what they don't talk about is all the babies that weren't born at that same time. They estimate another 600,000 births failed to occur. That's the silent loss of when you're killing off a young generation. Mao Zedong took over China in 1949, proceeded to orchestrate the deaths of 40 million of his own people through war and starvation. And then following World War II, there was a war in Korea, which the revolutionary king Kim Il-sung attempted to take over the entire Korean peninsula. The United States and others fought to a draw and divided the country into North and South Korea, a situation that remains to this day. North Korea is one of the poorest places on earth. In sharp contrast, South Korea is one of the most modern, prosperous countries on earth. Lower infant mortality, longer lifespan, a higher standard of living. The South Koreans are healthier, actually measurably standing inches taller than the North Koreans. And yet there was an artificial drawn line because it speaks to the difference in their diets. The South Koreans had higher protein and better health care. We go to 1959. Fidel Castro, the communist dictator, took over Cuba, had his political enemies lined up against the wall and shot. He instituted communism and people all suddenly became equal. They were poverty stricken. Unless, of course, you were one of the powerful elite. People have been trying to escape from Cuba ever since that time. South Florida has many refugees from Cuba or their offspring just 90 miles away from Florida. A United Church of God pastor, Mario Segley of Orange County, California, and his parents' family escaped from Cuba in that 1959 revolution. After World War II, Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam put in process the revolution that ultimately caused millions to die as the North Vietnamese took over the entire country. South Vietnam was purged of anyone who cooperated with the Americans and the South Vietnamese government. Many years ago, I had a 19-year-old, a new student from Vietnam, a girl who was 19, still in high school, had newly arrived in America. Her parents were killed. She somehow left Vietnam and came to live with an uncle in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And I asked her how many Vietnamese were killed after the Americans went home and the South Vietnamese government collapsed. And I guessed, is it about 3 million? And she said, and I will quote, way more than that. These are governments who killed their own people deliberately. In 1975, a dictator in Cambodia, Southeast Asia, named Pol Pot, he was a totalitarian revolutionary, another collectivist. He took over the country, and one of the first things he did was to shoot every educated person he could find, every doctor, teacher, religious leader, civil service professionals of any kind. He was determined to force immediate agrarian reform by marching people from the cities at gunpoint into the countryside. They didn't have time to pack a bag, no food, no clothes, just march them out into the country. If they had an illness or an injury, or if they needed meds, or if they were old or tired or crippled and couldn't keep up, they were simply shot and left by the side of the road. Official stories say 2 million people died in that state-sponsored genocide that's now chronicled by a book and a movie entitled The Killing Fields. Unofficially, it's millions more than that. In 1971, Idi Amin fomented a revolution in Uganda, Africa. He was a brutal dictator until he was ousted in 1978. Idi Amin's rule was characterized by human rights abuses, political repression, ethnic prosecution, extrajudicial killings, just go kill them if you don't like them, right? Nepotism, corruption, and about 500,000 people were killed in the little country of Uganda. Idi Amin confessed to cannibalism on several occasions, and I will put a quote. "I have eaten human meat," he said in 1976. "It is very salty, even more salty than leopard meat." Yet Idi Amin was the official government of Uganda at the time. What is in common with all of these killing governments? It's their false religion. They worship the creation instead of the creator. In Romans 1:25, I'm going to read this, Romans 1:25 in the English Revised Version. "They traded the truth of God for a lie. They bowed down and worshiped the things God made instead of worshiping the God who made these things. He is the one who should be praised forever." We know of all the governments that have ignored or dismissed or directly opposed the fourth commandment about keeping the seventh-day Sabbath. But notice that all of these regimes of mankind ignored the first three commandments in the Bible. They ignored the first commandment about understanding who is God and setting our priority to that God. They ignored that no false images of God. They've ignored a respect for God's name. We can call this false religion secular humanism, replacing God with a false hope of salvation by mankind itself. We're just going to make things better, and we can do it with fewer people, so we'll just wipe out one half of the room, whichever it is, and now we have fewer people to feed. Aha. See how easy that was? In fact, I don't have it in my notes, but I remember that Saddam Hussein of Iraq said, "We don't need 25 million Iraqis. We could run this country and produce enough oil to be all rich at 5 million people." He was willing to sacrifice 20 million of his own people. This, and of course some of these totalitarian collectivist governments simply wanted personal power, and to get the power, they played upon people's inclination for envy and coveting. In Colossians 3, verse 5, we read about that coveting. In Colossians 3 and verse 5. "Therefore, put to death your members, which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry." What does God say not to do? Don't get involved in idolatry. And yet covetousness is what led all of those countries down the path of killing their own people, because that was idolatry. They coveted what other people had. People want what other people have. They want their stuff. And to get that stuff, they're willing to lie, cheat, steal, or kill. Does that sound like violations of the other parts of the Ten Commandments? And the inclination to covet, I'm sorry to say, is taught in public schools today throughout the United States and around the world. We call it collectivism. For the would-be rulers, they start by ignoring the first four commandments. Then they covet. And when the intensive coveting gets built up, than they lie, cheat, steal, or murder to get the other people's stuff. This authoritarian collectivism is a false religion as much as Baal, Baphomet, Mithra, Jupiter, Buddha, Confucius, or any of the other false gods that we can name, except that the authoritarian collectivism doesn't always have an obvious image to go with it, as do many religions who have their icons, unless you call it the little passport card they want you to have in some countries now. But we can still know that these false religion humanists, because they openly promote and practice authoritarian collectivism in Matthew 7 and verse 15. In Matthew 7, 15, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous as wolves. Verse 16, for you will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Verse 17, Matthew 7, 17, even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. Ancient Israelites were tempted by false gods. When in the desert after the Exodus, they made a golden calf and pretended it was the real God that brought them out of Egypt. Later, the Israelites consorted with Moabite women, and they died in a plague as a direct consequence. The entire books of Joshua, of Judges, Kings, Chronicles, and the history books of the Old Testament display the challenges that the Israelites faced when facing false gods. We face the same challenges today. We must not be swayed by coveting, because coveting is idolatry. By following authoritarian collectivists leads us away from what God teaches us in the Bible, which is individual responsibility and individual reward. We can't get baptized for someone else. We can't take Passover for someone else. We can't keep the commandments for someone else. These are all things that we must each do for ourselves. We must not be swept away by modern false religion, whether it's gender bender pronoun usage, abortion, tax the other guy so I can get some of his stuff, or whether it has to do with climate, a pandemic, or the most deception religion of all, do what I tell you or you're not a loving person. Somehow, there always seems to be people in the world who want to tell other people what to do. And amazing, it's always there are people who want someone to tell them what to do. Well, we're responsible for ourselves. We are pointedly instructed in Philippians 2 and verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. We can't subcontract out our own personal salvation to someone else. We must be bold enough to seize our own future, to make our own decisions within the framework of God's law. Well, we live in an era of a new kind of modern false prophets. Prophets who teach false religion and pseudoscience. And here's a hint. Don't listen to science from people who can't tell the difference between a male and a female. Let's realize that the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments are the first three for a reason. The first commandment, to understand who is God and to set our priorities. The second commandment, to have no false images of God. The third commandment, have respect for God's name. And that is how we act, it's not just how we speak. We can and must stand up for the truth. Last scripture I have is Proverbs 25 and verse 26. In Proverbs 25, verse 26, I'm going to read this out of the Common English Bible. A righteous person giving in to the wicked is like a contaminated spring or a polluted fountain. In the Holman Christian Standard Bible, it reads similarly. A righteous person who yields to the wicked is like a muddied spring or a polluted well. Well, that's what we face. The world around us often gives in to the wicked. We must be different. We must learn diligently and what God expects from us. We must avoid being deceived, even by our own instincts or biases. And we must boldly participate in the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom of God, even if the only thing we can do is with prayer and our personal example. In any event, we must not bow down to Baal and all distractions that draw us away from the truths of God.